The title of this session is Let Them Eat Cake, and it's talk not about hunger and poverty in general, but hunger and poverty in America in particular. I noticed walking in here a couple of clippings on the back bulletin board there that one of them has a heading, half the world's population lives on $1 a day. There's another one talking about 244 million children under age 5 expected to starve between now and the year 2000. Clearly the biggest problem we have as a world in hunger and poverty is overseas. You've heard those stories about how the U.S. I have a little clipping here from several years ago. I don't know if these numbers are exactly right nowadays, but it says if the world were a global village of 100 people, 70 of them would be unable to read, only one would have a college education. Over 50 would be suffering from malnutrition, over 80 would live in what we call substandard housing. If the world were a global village of 100 residents, 6 of them would be Americans. These 6 would have almost half the village's entire income, and the other 94 would exist on the other half. How would the wealthy 6 live in peace with their neighbors? Surely they would be driven to arm themselves against the other 94, perhaps even to spend, as we do, more per person on military defense than the average per person income of all the others. And having said that, just as a little thing to keep in mind, that what we're talking about today is only one part of what we as Christians have to be concerned about, the poor and hungry. But so we're that wealthy 6% of the world's population. We also have hungry here. We also have poor people here. 20 years ago, it came to the attention of many Americans through some television documentaries, through Lyndon Johnson traveling through Appalachia. People became aware that there were actually people going hungry in America. It was a shock. It was awful, and the nation responded accordingly through massive outpouring of change in policy. We have the Great Society programs were the result of that. That was major changes as a nation. For the first time, well, since Social Security and the New Deal reforms, it was the first time we as a nation made some major steps to address the fact that people are going hungry in our country of wealth. Now, 20 years later, the image we have of the poor is not somebody starving in America. The poor in America is not somebody starving. It's more often a food stamp recipient driving a Cadillac and buying alcohol with the cash from the food stamps. When we think of the poor, we often think of laziness, irresponsibility, abuse of some programs. And yet, after all that, there still are 20% of Americans. There was a Gallup poll. This is 3 years old now. Have there been times during the last year when you did not have enough money to buy food for your family? From 1974 it was 14%, to 1984 it was 20%. Have there been times during the past year when you did not have enough money to pay for needed medical or health care? 25% said there were times in the past year they could not afford to. Obviously not all of these are desperate cases. Some of them are cases where people just ran short at the end of the month or before the next paycheck or whatever, and they were a little bit shy. But we're still talking not a small number of poor people. We're talking about a fifth of the nation unable to feed itself adequately. There are several ways we deal with this. One is we don't admit that there's a possibility that Gallup poll was correct. Well, who was he asking? And well, some people say, yeah, I was kind of hungry. I didn't have money to go to the store that day, but basically they could have eaten what was in the cupboard. And that's one thing. We don't admit the poll was correct. Or the second thing is we blame the poor. Well, if there weren't so many lazy ones, if they'd only go out and get a job, we wouldn't have that kind of problem. They wouldn't have to be suffering. It doesn't occur to us that for many of them, they can't find jobs. They don't have this, more likely because they don't have the skills necessary. They don't have the child care if they're a single parent. They don't have transportation. It's amazing to qualify for a lot of things. There are asset limits. You can't have more than a couple $1,000s in counted assets. In your house, your housing does not count as an asset, but your car does. So if you have a newer car, you can't have that and be on welfare, even if you had the car and you got laid off and one thing led to another. You you need an old car if you're going to have any car. And you try and get to work with an old car, that works fine, and most of us do it, but when you're on a marginal job and your car breaks down, you lose your job, or you don't have money for the part for the car, we try and simplify things in our mind, and it doesn't occur to us that some of these asset limits may sometimes block somebody from the transportation they need. We forget about people with mental or physical disabilities. Not all disabilities are apparent to us. Some people have, from birth, either mental illness of some sort or another. When you hear the statistics, it's a massive percentage of the population has some sort of mental illness. Most of it's just minor paranoia or something like that. But we all have, we're not all 100% wholesome, rounded, 100% mentally healthy people. It's not like you're mentally ill or you're healthy. Everybody has different shades of that, and some people have worse disabilities than others, and for them to get jobs is not as easy as we'd like to think. And before I get into describing what I think the problems are and why we, in my mind, are getting ourselves into a deeper hole, I want to describe what I think has been happening over the past 7, 8, maybe the past 10, 12 years. First of all, we've had an increase in the last 3 or 4 years at least of church and nonprofit assistance. There are shelters, food shelves. In Minnesota, there's been a massive increase. Every year you see the food shelves have a doubling of number of clients, and they've been roughly meeting the need. I mean, you could argue they could use more, but public giving has increased. The churches have gone out of their way more and more are getting involved in food shelf efforts. So there's a big increase in church and nonprofit effort. Largely due to what's happening at the same time over the past perhaps 10 years, but most heavily in the last 6 or 7 years, that's massive cuts in federal programs. In theory, what we're told is happening is we're going to eliminate waste while still meeting the needs of the truly needy. Truly needy is not quite defined, but I think what it means is the people who are on the verge, if they don't have the assistance, they're going to be starving. Federal aid cuts have been continual. Every year it's a little bit more and a little bit more. There have been attempts to abolish legal aid, massive cuts in the WIC, Women, Infants, and Children program, AFDC, which most people think of as welfare, food stamps. They've had a number of cuts over the last several years. Social Security, disability, they've made it very tough to qualify. Lots of people who the courts have said, courts have told federal government to stop making, automatically rejecting claims that are, at their face value, legitimate. And they've been just rejecting claims, and some of these take a year for somebody to get help. There was the attempt, well publicized several years ago, to declare ketchup as a vegetable in school lunches. School lunches have been cut overwhelmingly. Low-income housing has been cut. And politicians in general have a real advantage. If I talk up the fact that I think we got to eliminate waste and welfare, it's a real plus for me in my district, and I think most politicians in their own home territory. If you talk about cutting welfare and, well, cutting the waste in welfare, it's a political advantage. So politicians go what you might call welfare bashing. And whether they believe they're cutting waste or not, most of the time, the waste is the thing that doesn't get cut, but people who are in need get cut. So that's what I'd argue is happening. In the last number of years, welfare has become the shift from all of these poor people in our country, we got to help them, to now we started helping them, but we did a whole bunch of bad things, and now they're just a bunch of lazy people, and government's got to get out of that, which it's been doing, and the church has got to get into it, which has been happening. And my proposal, my thesis is that all of that is making our problem worse, and it's going to continue to get worse unless we have some major changes in the way we deal with the poverty question. And I wrote on the board several issue areas I wanted to talk about. First one, the church's role. I would propose that the church has a legitimate role in helping those in need. And the church has been doing a very good job in trying to respond to it. But I have several problems with that. One is the idea that the church ought to be the legitimate provider of it, not government, leaves it perfectly somebody's human needs to charity, which charity is a good thing, but that's leaving it to chance whether somebody gets a job, whether somebody has enough food to eat. And I'm not sure that that's something we, if we think about it, really want. We don't want kids to be, well, we hope somebody gives them food because people really care about these kids, but kids fall in the cracks sometimes and so they go hungry. It's leaving the welfare of the poor to chance. It's not addressing a major part of it. It's providing food, emergency food and shelter. It's not providing the social services, the job training, the employment possibilities. It's not solving the problem. It's a temporary stopgap measure. Another thing is it's difficult to coordinate benefits. Some people, if you're worried about people wasting, if you're wasting abuse, well, how do you do it? Food shelves can't have the systematic, how many times have you been here in the last year, that's all they ask, and you're only allowed a certain number of visits per year. Is somebody who knows how to milk the system, if that's what your theory of how poor people treat the system, they could go to different food shelves all the time and they could do very well, perhaps. So you can't coordinate benefits well. And mainly, the biggest problem with this whole thing, too, is that it's not sufficient resources to meet the needs. A number of years ago, when Reagan first took office, he had proposed that maybe we ought to just get government out of the process, and by cutting taxes as a result of that, people will have more to spend themselves, they'll be more generous, they'll give more to help them, and the churches ought to do this. And if you divide up the number of poor people by the number of churches in the country, you end up with something like about 10 poor families for every church in the country. And the larger churches, yeah, that might not be a big problem, assuming all the poor people are where all the churches are and it was evenly distributed. It's not like we're in all small town America anymore where there may be 10 poor families in one church to take care of them, but you may have a mass of them in a few city blocks and churches nowhere near there, or poor churches near there who don't have the money to do it. But if you take the average size of an American congregation, I don't know whether it's 200, 300, 400, 500, I don't know what it is, but if you try and have them meet all the social needs of a family, of 10 families, they won't have any time to do anything else the church is supposed to do. And it means you're in effect saying the church doesn't have a role as a church, it has a role as providing for the hungry and in the local community. No teaching, no preaching, no worship, no anything, because you don't have the resources for it. So I would suggest that the church has a very legitimate role in meeting stopgap needs, but what we have been doing is pushing more onto it. And the church in no way, either financially or efficiency-wise, could possibly provide for providing jobs and job training in a logical way for the people who need the help. So the next point I wanted to talk about was the idea of waste and fraud. And I would suggest that there is no evidence of great abuse. The proof of abuse in the welfare system is by anecdote. You hear about, as I mentioned earlier, the food stamp recipient in the Cadillac, and there clearly are people who are well off who don't need things, who are somehow or another getting benefits. In Minnesota, the AFDC error rate, which is supposed to be government errors and private sector taking advantage of it, is less than 2%, and it's been that way for a long time. Minnesota's been the lowest in error rate, but I mean the highest seems to be 5-6%. Is that massive ripping off of the system? Are the guidelines too lenient? If our theory is that these people are getting something for free from us and therefore we got to crack down on them as tight as possible, there may be some people getting a few extra benefits. The idea of a lot of people who, this 20% who runs out of food sometime during the month, they're not all driving Cadillacs, they're not all wasting the money, and the fact that some people may buy alcohol when they're low income, they have their weaknesses, they're human the same way we are. And I would suggest that there's no indication, if we want to crack down on waste and fraud, there's no indication that the poor as a whole are less honest in their applying for welfare benefits than the middle and upper class are in filling out their income tax forms. And while we do have an auditing system I, for one, have never been audited. I kind of hope I never am, because I hear the pain it is for people who have it. But the only check we have is an occasional audit. Otherwise, people can fudge, yeah, the cash contributions to church or this or that. Oh, yeah, I think I gave a lot. And not really careful record keeping, and tend to, I don't know if you call it cheating, it's just kind of little exaggeration. And there's no evidence that the poor are any less honest than everyone else of us. And yet, we do make strict loopholes they have to go through. They have to bring in records. There's a burden of proof on them in applying for welfare benefits. And I'm not saying that that's not all appropriate. I'm just suggesting that if we think that the poor are by and large ripping off the system, we ought to do another look at the whole scheme of things. The truly needy, this is, I think I'll get to that one in another minute, because I want to do that. Let's take the deserving versus non-deserving. That's one reason what we've been doing for our welfare programs. You got to test people. You've got to make sure they have kids before you give them benefits, because, well, people with kids, they kind of kids deserve welfare. I don't think there's anybody who disagrees with that kids need help. If they're not responsible for paying their own income, they're supposed to be growing up and learning and preparing themselves to contribute to society. So we categorize people in kind of single male is in very few states qualifies for any sort of welfare, because, well, they can take care of themselves. It's the women with young children who we see as deserving. So there's that sort of theory on our own behind all these welfare programs that some people deserve and some people don't. If you have a serious enough disability, then you deserve help. If you don't have a serious enough disability, well, why don't you go out and get a job? And behind all our welfare programs seems to be that philosophy. No trust that somebody will try and better themselves. This totally ignores the fact that some people who may be, quote, non-deserving in our thinking can't get jobs, or that they, as I mentioned earlier, have disabilities. And one other point that I thought made this very well is we often talk about how valuable our free market system is, and providing incentives is very important to us. And John Kenneth Galbraith a couple years ago was talking about supply-side economics, which was to cut taxes for the wealthy, because then they would get to keep a higher percentage of what they earn. And if you keep a higher percentage of what you earn, you're going to have more incentive to work hard. And therefore, you need those strong incentives. And John Kenneth Galbraith pointed out the accepted such and such holds that the rich are working because they have too little money, and the poor aren't working because they have too much, which sort of summarizes what we've been doing, in effect. If you think about that, we are cutting taxes for the wealthy over the 1981 tax cut and so on. We cut massive tax cuts for the wealthy because they needed more incentive to work. If you have $100,000 and you're going to be, and you're taxed at, what was it, one time 70% rate, then 50, now 33% rate. Well, if you were taxed at 50% rate, you only get to keep half of what you earn. There's not much incentive to work, even if it is at $40 an hour. Therefore, you need to be able to keep more of that, and therefore, cutting your taxes will help you do that. On the other hand, our way of dealing with the poor isn't by saying, listen, there's this minimum wage job. We will let you keep $3 an hour of that minimum wage if you work, because we think you need incentive to work. Instead, we go, if you're working, we ought to force a workfare kind of program on you. If you're receiving benefits, you ought to work. And I don't have any disagreements if you're receiving benefits, you ought to work. I just think that people work very poorly if you're forced to work, you try and get out of it as much as you can. If you're given some incentive, you will tend to work harder. And if we think that the wealthy ought to have their taxes, only one-third of their income taken in taxes instead of one-half, then maybe we ought to think that the poor who are getting minimum wages ought to be able to keep 50% of their income rather than basically zero. Because the way our welfare system works is that if you earn a dollar, you tend to be receiving a dollar, you lose a dollar of your welfare. Mm-hmm. And when you throw in child care and transportation costs to work and other expenses you have as a result of your job, even if you're significantly above minimum wage, you may be better off not working, which continues the system. And from that, I want to lead into this truly needy idea. That's based on the vision of people being either fully self-sufficient, like I think we all are, or totally dependent. And many people are somewhere in between. They have some skills, but they can only get a minimum wage job. They need another year of education to get this teaching job. They need something to make them fully self-sufficient. Maybe they have a job that can pay their way, but their kid gets sick and they have no medical care. So the only way they can get medical assistance coverage is by quitting work and going on welfare. Many people are in between, and the talk the last few years about how we're going to provide for the truly needy, and as I said earlier, I think that means those who are presumably going to starve if we don't help them. By doing that, we're playing up to the biggest mistakes of the Great Society programs. I would argue that what the Great Society programs did best was take care of the truly needy. It stopped, to a large part, that poll I saw in 1974, only 14% of the American public had times in the past month where they couldn't feed their family because of lack of money. The Great Society programs did help address those truly needy people. The trouble was with the Great Society programs where it festered a dependency. If you were on welfare, you either had to be able to pull yourself immediately to total self-sufficiency or stay on welfare. There was no real middle ground. It's kind of like a ladder of self-sufficiency. We have a good first step. If you're going to be sinking in the mud, you can get on that first step of some basic welfare benefits. You try and get the next step, some education, some job training, some medical care when you find your first low-income job. There, none of those rungs are there. So unless you can jump that gap to the self-sufficiency level or near self-sufficiency, you're stuck down on the bottom rung. And if you happen to be self-sufficient and then all of a sudden you have a catastrophic illness that you can't pay for, or you get laid off for a year and a half and you start losing your house and everything else, you fall from there and there's nothing in between to stop your fall. You end up on the bottom rung. And as a result, we tend to have a lot of people on the bottom rung, and then we complain about how expensive welfare is because there's all these people down there and they're not doing anything to get out of it. And I would argue that while many people who are down on that rung don't have a lot of oomph, get up and go, and enthusiasm about, I want to get a job, they may not have the right attitudes. Maybe what they need is somebody to give them, first of all, an incentive to have those right attitudes, and then a help. I mean, kind of we kick them in the teeth instead of giving them a helping hand. We have to do something to help them. And therefore, this move in the last few years talking about the truly needy, what that has been doing, in effect, is saying, hey, there are some of these near poor people who we're helping with welfare, and we don't want to help them. We want to save money, which you do by cutting them off the welfare rolls, tightening income limitations and so on, and then we're still going to take care of the truly needy. I would argue what the consequences really are is, first of all, we do have some cuts that hurt those really truly needy, and the biggest problem though is that the people who are on the verge of pulling themselves out have another couple of rungs of that ladder pulled away from them. So we need a boost in self-sufficiency. We need to provide work incentive. We need to fill in some of those gaps in the ladder that the Great Society programs provided the bottom couple rungs to, but not the in-between ones. And so I will argue that Ronald Reagan, in talking about the truly needy, is correct in the short term. You save a few bucks by cutting out those people on the fringe, but what we actually ought to be doing is filling in more for those people on the fringe to help them get up there. One other one I wanted to talk about was the fear of involvement in the job market. I would suggest that government ought to be ought to be in a position of helping anyone who doesn't have a job find a job some way or another. The other day we had a talk, and one of the questions hinted, well, what about the need for contribution to society? You don't just throw money at people. You gotta give them some dignity, some self-worth, and what the person seemed to be suggesting was a job. And I would argue that's a very important part. We all need to contribute. There are numerous studies of relationship between unemployment and crime, unemployment and numerous other social ills. Minnesota, 62% of our prisons are filled with people who had committed crimes at a time when they were unemployed. You could always argue that, well, they're just lazy, didn't want to work, and those tend to be the criminal types, which there may be some of that, but I would also argue there tends to be some tendency that if you don't have any meaning in life, if you are not busy trying to contribute something, you have, first of all, less to lose by committing a crime, more time to commit a crime, less incentive to be a fully part of society in a law-abiding manner. And yet we as a government are very shy about getting involved in the jobs, in the job world. That's partly because of a over-reliance or trust in the free market system to meet all social needs by itself without any regulation. There are people who say we don't need a minimum wage because people ought to be paid what their work is worth. And I believe people ought to be paid what their work and their skills are worth as well, but the free market system doesn't account for that. In northern Minnesota these days, there are lots of steel workers who work very hard and fairly low-skill jobs, but there's skill involved in a lot of those jobs, and some of them are fairly high-skilled. They were paid pretty well, $14 an hour for some. Some were paid much more than that, some a little bit less than that. All of a sudden, in a two-year period of time, they're all earning nothing. They're on welfare, unemployment compensation till that runs out, or they're struggling to find minimum wage jobs. Did they all of a sudden, did their skills or value of their work go down? No, it was something they couldn't control. Hold in mind, 1957, people were gainfully employed, had houses here. Overnight, because of some changes in the price of copper, they were told, goodbye, we don't need you anymore. And at that time, I believe unemployment wasn't as, well, it's not as big of a problem as it is now. And presumably most of them, over a period of time, did find new jobs. But it shows that the free market system is not exactly balanced in the way it is in theory. It's not, if I'm more skilled, harder working, more brilliant, I'm going to get a better paying job than you are. It doesn't work that way. We all, it's kind of a chance system in effect. There is some connection, but it's not perfect. And the other reason I would argue that we have this reluctance is because we have this image of public jobs is make work jobs. WPA in the 30s was, I'm told, it was nicknamed We Piddle Around because people just goofing around all the time. People not doing their work, but you look back at all the bridges built, all the projects done by people who had no other, no hope, no contribution to society. All of a sudden, they were contributing something. It's pretty good business. Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there were some people who didn't work hard. I'm sure there are in private sector jobs as well, but there were some good things done. Those are the kind of things we could do now. And for the people who say government ought not be involved in the public sector, in the job sector, I would suggest that I'd much rather see somebody working for an income than receiving welfare for an income. And even if it costs a bit more, and I would argue that it's going to cost more. You can't say, well, we're going to cut welfare benefits back. Then you're kicking the truly needy that you, in theory, want to protect. And if you say, okay, you're either truly needy or working, and there's no in-between, no borderline thing where you can't quite support yourself on your own, but some need some help, then we're not going to give you anything. If you're going to provide incentives for people, you have to pay some welfare benefits to people who have jobs. You have to phase it out. Otherwise, for every dollar you earn, you got to yank away a welfare dollar, which takes away every incentive, financial incentive to work. So that point, I would suggest we have a real fear of being involved in the private sector as far as jobs. And I would also suggest that that's unhealthy. Not that we should be trying to put people in government jobs, but that we should have a preference for some job over welfare, over unemployment. And that can provide training, it can provide everything else. At the same time, it's providing a useful service to society. And then the hope is that at some time, we can get those people onto full private sector jobs. Now, go ahead.
I just had a couple comments to make. One is the church's role. I think it's ironic that while government, particularly this administration, has said the church and private sector should play a much more significant role in that, at the same time, in terms of income taxes, for those people who were contributing to charitable organizations, that's a deduction that's being phased out. And I think that's truly ironic. I'm sure the word is that's going to be an overall cut. The truth is, you know, that's not going to happen. All it's going to do is decrease the incentive, just like the other programs that have been put into effect have done. Another comment, one of the things that I see frequently, I'm a Spanish-speaking social worker at a county hospital, and one of the effects that I've seen in terms of the health care programs and just programs, welfare programs in general, is that it's pushed more people to the brink. Exacerbated medical situations to the people we get now are far more ill than they would have been if they'd been able to come in at an earlier point and treated. Their stay would have been shorter. The overall cost would have been far less. The short-term ramifications of that look good on paper, but what all it's done is simply reallocated who has to pay for it. It's moved the burden from federal government to state and local government. And the cost is not limitations on which hospitals can take Medi-Cal. Well, what that's done is left private hospitals half empty and the county hospital overburdened. So it creates a definite shift, but I'm not sure that it's the kind of shift that's beneficial. Sure. I would agree with you in that I think the long-term ramifications of what the policies have done is in fact create a whole other group of truly needy, because there's so many that have pushed so far that it's a much harder recovery than it would have been had there been intervention at an earlier point. The recovery period would have been shorter and easier.
And that's another example of one more of those rungs and middle rungs in the ladder being pulled out. And, the attempt, the blasting of the Great Society programs seems to be done by the same people who keep feeding into the biggest mistake of them, and that was not enough middle rungs. We were going to take care of the people who were at the bottom, and the one failure of the Great Society, the greatest failure, which increased overall the dependency, the permanence of dependency of some people, we're adding to that now, and medical care is another one. Instead of any preventive stuff, we tend to be pushing away from that. I want to quickly go through with what I would see as a vision for how we ought to be getting out of this, and then open up for discussion, and I'll do it quickly so we can get there. First of all, have the basis that everybody ought to be contributing to society and to the extent possible. It means everybody ought to have an opportunity to work and ought to have some incentive to want to work and want to contribute to society.
Does that mean everybody pays taxes too?
Everybody, I would like to see taxes based on ability to pay, which would mean that
if it was a dollar, so that they contribute also?
True. I would like to see everybody contribute that way too, yes. And I would hope to see everybody earning enough income that they can meet their basic needs and contribute to the overall costs of government as well. Yes, I think that is. That way you feel you're partly responsible for government, and the same way you feel you're responsible in contributing to society through a job. I think the more everybody can, we all can participate, the better. And
does that exclude zero and reverse income tax, though?
Well, I would suggest that if you're below income, a possible way, and it depends how you want to label this, possible way for deciding who is getting welfare benefits, you could have, I mean, it would simply be a restructuring. Instead, if your income's up here, you're paying this much in taxes, and as your income falls, your taxes go down. As your income hits a certain level, then, or as it falls below that, then, in effect, the taxes go to you.
Yeah, I thought that's what you had in mind when you were speaking of middle rungs, and that's why I'm surprised that you answered her the way you did, that in fact no. everyone would pay.
No, I'm saying right now, half the people can't, well, not right. half the people, a lot of people can't pay.
Right.
And what I'm saying is, but I don't care if we call it a negative income tax, but somehow or another what we ought to do is determine where people need help. We ought to have a basic minimum, basic floor, by which everybody has enough food, shelter, medical care, and so on, and then have the steps up from there where they can do this. And once somebody's met their basic needs and they start doing these other things, in effect what you're doing right now, if I am on welfare and I find a minimum wage job right now, if you want to look at it as a negative income tax, the welfare being the negative right. income tax, right. then for every dollar I earn, I'm losing a dollar of that, so I'm in effect paying a tax, I'm paying back that right there. So if everybody's at that cap and you have a 50% incentive, so if I get a minimum wage job, I get to keep half of it,
yeah.
then what you'd be doing is I earn $3 an hour or $3.50 an hour, and I give $1.75 back in taxes or reduced welfare benefits, depending on how you want to call it.
See, I was saying that I think everybody should pay something, even if it's a dollar.
But what
so they are contributing, I mean, it's all semantics in a sense. What you're saying mm-hmm. is they get it back. But I'm saying that symbolically they should fill out an income tax and send their dollar in, because everybody should contribute.
If you want to do it that way, then what you'd need is an income tax, a negative income tax, a form. And where's your income fall on the graph? It's right here. Okay, and then everybody starts out with that basic amount, and then, I mean, if you label it wrong, you're going to have what George McGovern called demo grants, where everybody in the country starts out with this level of income, and then from there on, then of course, if I'm a millionaire and I'm getting this $1,000 demo grant or whatever it was, then my taxes would be increased by $1,000. So in effect, I'm not getting anything. But depending, yeah, you're right. It's all semantics. But what it ought to be is everybody sees that the more they earn, they are contributing, they are paying back into society a greater percentage, though I would also suggest that if you did that at the bottom end, once you start out with this basic grant that everybody's going to get, moving from there, you're going to have, if you don't have a 50% or close to that, you're going to have an incredibly expensive welfare program. I don't know if that answers both of your. I hope that you see what I'm trying to say.
The spirit of that. I don't see in any way that we're saying opposite things. I think another way of handling that is to re-educate people into redefining what we call welfare. We think of charity again, right?
Mm-hmm.
And think of it as entitlement. Everyone is entitled to be secure and to have opportunity in this country. And that period of time may be parallel to a student between the years 17 and 21 who's receiving a lot from government, from parents, and the like. This is not a parasite in the society at all. We don't define that as welfare or charity. That's investment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we could look at the negative income tax as investment, bringing people, as you are saying, I am completely convinced by your program, that you can really build a sense of pride among what we call welfare recipients. They are being equipped to become full participants. And if giving a buck a year does it, that's fine. But I think that giving a buck a year is because we have convinced people, brainwashed them into thinking welfare is simply a free trip. And so they need that symbolic dollar to kind of, I think that may not be the most effective way, but the reason you're giving for it, I agree with completely, to give people a sense of pride.
I think the way we'd be doing it, I mean, it depends on what you're calling it, and it's all a matter of semantics,
yeah.
whether it's going to be a negative income tax or it's going to be a welfare program. When you start earning money, and we give you this basic amount one way or another to make sure you don't starve, you don't go hungry, all your needs are basically met. Then you start working, whether it's minimum wage or higher wage, and you immediately start contributing back what you were getting. Not at the same rate you're earning the dollars, but at a lower rate, so you have some incentive to do it.
How do you, any system like this means in effect that you're subsidizing McDonald's, because instead of having to pay whatever the rate is, they will be able to pay a lower rate because you would be a man who's on welfare would be able to work at McDonald's at a lower rate. And so you'd be subsidizing McDonald's and all those places that use typically either retired people or younger people.
Minnesota just had a debate on minimum wage, and the argument was, well, the market ought to take care of this, and the burden it's going to place on McDonald's and other places. And my response would be simply that without the minimum wage, in effect, yes, people aren't earning enough. Well, kids don't need enough to support themselves, but that anybody other than the kids who are working at McDonald's are not earning enough to support themselves, and therefore we as a society are subsidizing it. And that's, yes, that's the case right now. We have a lot of people who are earning no more than the minimum wage, and yeah, they're willing to work there because...
What would you do, for instance, about someone who was getting a large amount of welfare and then volunteered to work at Holden for a year for nothing? You still keep giving the welfare?
I would suggest...
You're not earning anything. Right. So you get welfare for a year to come to Holden.
Or doesn't have any expenses, yeah. So.
Well, yes, but I know people in society that are not doing it through Holden, but are doing exactly the same thing, and these are people that are perfectly well-skilled. I know a family, he used to work for me, he quit, went on welfare, and he works for the Baptist Church for free and draws welfare the full time. Now he can come back and work for me again at a good paying job, or do better yet, because the man is very skilled and very talented. But he's made that option. I want to say one more thing about that. Please don't let that count. That's that anecdote thing.
Yeah.
Because people that are deserving, non-deserving, truly needy, I don't believe in that. This guy has jumped through the loops and done it, and that's fine. I'm not complaining about that so much, because those people are going to be through this thing no matter what, and in order to get to the truly needy or the non-deserving.
Yeah, there is that.
And granted, I don't want that guy doing that.
Yeah.
And I'm very upset with it personally. But if he doesn't, then somebody else is going to come along, or what will happen is he'll take the job that somebody else is doing that I would hire him to do, and then that guy would have to go on welfare. So it's, you know, I mean, it's a real messy thing, and I don't think that's even the issue. Except there are people that do that.
But on a broader scale, the Speenham land laws in England, they said there's too many farm laborers who are not getting by, so we'll subsidize them. And every parish had to set aside money to subsidize farm laborers. You know what happened? For the next 200 years, instead of getting a dollar a day for farm labor, they got 25 cents. Because they didn't need more, because the poor law would pay for the rest of the money they needed to support themselves. And so in effect, welfare can have that, has in the past, had the influence of driving down real wages. You know, that's because if you give someone money on welfare as an employer, I have to say, fine, then I have to pay them as much money. And you're going to subsidize them so that whatever rate they're working at, they have a living wage. That means that the employers, or some employers anyway, don't have to pay a living wage anymore.
But then go ahead.
If you've got government subsidizing people who are out in the workforce, you forget one thing. They're out in the workforce, and they're looking, and they're seeing what other people are doing. And they are getting educated.
Yeah.
That they are getting on their own, and they will see a way out. But if they can't even get the job at McDonald's with a little help, they don't even see a way out. But if they can see a way out, or how to get a job at a car wash,
but then it seems that
$8 an hour rather than, you know,
but then
you got away from there.
You got a problem then. If you have welfare to supplement income, then you don't want minimum wages. If someone's only worth 10 cents an hour, supplement it so he can have a living wage. Get rid of the minimum. You know, you really have one or the other. If you have both, you have a situation where you're keeping people from working because they can't contribute, and therefore you're paying everything.
You can perfectly well have both the minimum wage and the basic minimum. What you're doing then is they're paying it back in taxes. They're not paying it through reduced rates to the employer. And also, if you are having a full employment economy, if you do have that, then the free market is going to take care of the fact that some employers start paying less. Then you simply start looking for your jobs elsewhere. It doesn't have to. There is clearly the risk of what you're saying happening, but there are ways to protect somewhat against it. And as you said, yeah, there are people who can abuse anything you do, and there's no perfect way to do it. But we're not talking about a generous welfare system that makes it a very luxurious lifestyle for not working. We're talking about meeting basic human needs. And
well, I was interested to know what the status is in Washington State, because they were doing a development on a program to have these kinds of incentives built in. Along with child care, and I know that that's not, I don't believe it's been implemented yet. I believe it was last fall when they were trying to go through the final development of it. Are you in touch with
I wouldn't know. Somebody else mentioned to me that there had been a lot done in Washington lately. And
well, I thought that nationally that Washington was being looked at to see how their model worked out, to have it be applied, and then to see that we work for a national model. And it sounds like you're...
We've done in Minnesota this year. A lot of states are in the verge of trying this. Mm-hmm. The trouble is there are a lot of federal restrictions on what you can do.
Right.
But there are, like for instance, this year we for the first time provided some health care for low-income working poor, because that was one of the major disincentives, where not only you lose your welfare, but as soon as you get a job, you lose your medical assistance as well. And I'm told Washington did something. I don't. Maybe one of you two can.
Well, I just like to comment. The state of Washington had a program, and they, from what I understand, they've just taken it off the books, so they don't have it anymore. But this is government, to me, at its absolute worst. They would give $315 a month cash to alcoholics and wineries to help them out so they could feed themselves adequately. Now, what in the world is an alcoholic or a wino going to do with $315 cash?
Were they given cash, or were they given...
Given in cash.
But you know, it's not specifically alcoholics and winos, though. It was everybody. I mean, not everybody.
Well, no, it was basically aimed at helping the alcoholic and the wino on Skid Row. And the first thing the alcoholic would do when he got his money is he'd go to the first co-op house and pay his rent of maybe 90 or 80 bucks a month, and he'd take the rest of his money and go out and buy his bottle of wine. Now, what kind of a welfare system is that?
Well, there's a problem there. That is that there aren't enough spaces in alcohol and drug programs or follow-up.
Well, what a way, I mean, to me, it's just incredible that you help somebody out by giving them cash so they can go out and create a worse living hell for them.
I can't comment on that, not being familiar, but I see a couple.
I would say my comment is what I'm saying about this fellow that I know.
Well,
it's exactly the same thing, and I don't have any problem with it. I used to, I don't anymore.
Well, I do.
Maybe I would agree. Maybe you should go feed these people rather than give them cash.
Yes.
But the problem is that person, and my experience is not great, but it is somewhat with them, that person is going to walk right by that place that he can be fed, because he's still going to go find his 99-cent bottle of wine someplace.
How do you help people so that you can guard? I work in a social concerns program with my church, and we feed the poor in our neighborhood. We take it from donations from the church, and we get perhaps on a good month, we get $100 check in donations or $150 check, and this goes towards paying rent, light, eating food, anything that the poor neighborhood requires. And we run across such extremes in working with these people from the needy, who are very sincere, who come to us, who really need food for the day and who sincerely need our help, to people who call, who go down and listen. You hear them on our tape recorder, they don't think that we can hear them. Tell them a real sad story. You know, just tell them you don't have anything in your cupboard. And boy, will they, you know, they'll really get to you. And it's real interesting to see the differences in these people. And on the programs, we have a Christmas program where we bring presents, and we're also a sanctuary church with Salvadorians. And I was bringing presents to the poor families, and I was explaining to one of the Salvadorian children that we also have poor in our country, and that what our program is and how we're going to help them, and explained to them, and they were very excited to bring these gifts to the poor people. And we walk in this house that happens to be two stories. It has a color TV set and VCR, and cable on top of the TV set with kids sitting and eating macaroni and cheese in front of the TV set and the mom in the kitchen cooking, and we're going to bring these guys, and they're, this is your poor people. and bringing in the great contradictions. But then on the other hand, as we took these gifts, and what made me angry was that we were giving these people the presents, and then we would have nothing left over when somebody else would come to us who was completely hungry. We would say, I'm sorry, we're out of money.
Well, I think it's really important that people that do feel that we have to have a more just system of supporting real needs attend to corruption in welfare systems and the like. For one thing, we shouldn't waste money, as you say, because others need it. But another reason is, this is what's jumped on by opponents of these systems.
Yes.
If we run sloppy systems, we really lend ammunition to those that would like to kill all of these systems. However, as you were indicating, John, you know, you got down at 2% in Minnesota, maybe 5 nationwide. Any industry is going to deal with the fact of waste and inefficiency. As you were saying, it doesn't bother you overly much because you know that it's inevitable that a certain waste factor is built into that. I think above all, a church and supporting programs have to realize that there is risk involved when you stand, when you advocate justice. The Good Samaritan risked his life. There was no guarantee that his system of health care was going to be utterly efficient. He might have squandered everything he had, namely his lifeblood, but he did it. I think the church has to realize that grace sometimes is a bit reckless. Certainly that's a better alternative than to turn up our proud noses on the poor and saying, go to hell. Now, I learned from an atheistic Jew a powerful lesson. I was coming back from San Diego, having given a lecture on peace and war. And I arrived in Logan Airport in Boston, and getting on the subway with me was a guy saving the same, $15 cab fare, George Wald, laureate, peace winner in biology. He had been in Sacramento, because he now is really on the peace trail. And we came in Harvard Square, and I said, George, we can give you a ride. My wife is waiting here at the end of the subway line. We were going to our car, and he stopped in his boots, and he looked at a man who was holding his hand out, and without thinking, he put a dollar in his hand. And we walked away. I was kind of astonished, because I don't give bums dollars to buy alcohol, with my good, pious upbringing. And he looked at me with a grin, and he said, and did you see that guy was really drunk? Now, that, he didn't ask what he was going to do with it. He gave the guy what might warm him up for an hour. And I thought, my God, here a Jew taught me a lesson in Christian charity.
It wouldn't have been better to take that dollar and take him to a restaurant.
As someone said, he had to give two hoots about food in a restaurant, you know. We can't build a welfare system on throwing money at alcoholics to buy booze. But on the other hand, I learned only one lesson. It was like a parable. You know, a parable doesn't give you a whole theological system. That gave me a lesson in you don't bleed reason to death when you're dealing with a poor person. I don't know. There was a lesson to you. Maybe it's not clear.
Just let her comment first.
To go back to what you're saying, to go along with that, our church is the only church in Spokane to much controversy that does our own social concern program. Most of the other churches will give monthly support to
Salvation Army.
To Salvation Army or something. We do our own, and the reason why our whole policy is so that we can get to know another side of our society, so that we can be with them. And what we try to do is to help them as people to people, not in a pious manner. It's, well, we have some, you know, we're going to help you out. But to get to know that to try to see these people as ourselves and to get to know the other side. And our policy is, as I've said before, we see both extremes, but to never say no. That if somebody asks of us, we give. And because we don't know what's going on in their lives, we cannot judge. We're not there to judge.
Follow up on that. Okay. Go ahead. No, you.
Oh, I think also that gets back to the church role. I'm from Portland, and I'm involved with some of the homeless families advocacy and networking. And it's one of the endemic problems is churches are very interested in helping, but they also don't they need some of the professional aspects that an organization, let's say, can fulfill. And currently, Portland does have some churches that are providing shelter and food to homeless families. But the way that it has been developed is that the families that come to the church shelters first go through a neighborhood social service agency that does the screening, so that you can make sure that, you know, who's coming into the shelter is appropriate to that community. The communal style of living that you have in the facility, but also that you get what we call case management or case planning support, so that family can be helped on some of those other steps. The biggest problem that we see in Portland is not only the transportation link, but also the job training. You can have a homeless family, and that family can be willing to work and accept minimum wage jobs, but without any of the health care benefits, the minimum wage jobs are non-existent. They can be immediately thrust back into, they're at poverty level even at a minimum wage job. But if they have any medical problems or transportation needs or childcare needs, it doesn't do anything to break the chain. It just becomes a cycle. And that's why I personally feel a strong need for job training programs with the incentives where they, or if they take the entry level positions, they are learning things, as you had expressed, but then to be able to keep a percentage of that income so that then they can progress in their development of skills.
Okay, yeah. A couple more comments.
I have
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry if I'm not picking. Okay, go ahead.
My question goes back to something you talked about a while ago. We've kind of gotten off track, and I have a question for you in terms of what your vision is. You're talking about a basic rate, and I'm wondering how you would address that in terms of the disparity from one region to another. What will meet the basic needs in one region may very well not meet the basic needs in another region. And I think, for example, of say Alabama versus California.
Standard living in
there. Mm-hmm. Or New York.
But there's a basic rate for this area, there's a basic rate for this area, and that's gonna be a pretty cumbersome system.
We already do a number of things like that, and I'm not disagreeing that it's awkward, and it's not there is no perfect way to do it. We were in San Francisco on our way out here, and Oakland area, looking at, just happened to see one of these real estate booklets and picked it up, and housing prices are at least 2.5 times what they are in Minneapolis. It's just at least twice as high. And yeah, you have to take into account those things. And also, there is no perfect way of determining what need is. If we're going to have a basic floor that everybody's protected against these things, we're going to meet their health care needs, we're going to provide enough food for them. Your comments, too. I mean, what's human need? I mean, here a family's got a color TV and VCR and eating macaroni and cheese. There is no perfect way to determine.
I'm just thinking in terms of, I mean, if you want to live in say, the Bay Area in California, I mean, to even have a crummy studio apartment for a family of four, you're looking at $400 a month, and that's the crummiest as they come. Then on top of that, if you want food, that's for a family of four at least $200 a month. And your welfare grant for a family of four is probably $500. And you'll get $100, $150 worth of food stamps. You're going to have a heck of a time paying PG&E on top of, electricity, lights, just the things that go with the apartment. There's nothing left. You don't have money for transportation.
That's why I'm suggesting what we do is, I'm not spending all my time for vision for the future is not on how we can modify where our grant levels are, but more suggesting what we do with somebody who's right on the edge of that, how we can push them on. Right now, it's a disincentive to work. Provide some incentive. I'd argue $1.50 an hour isn't a real great incentive. Not for the people who think we need tax cuts for people earning $100,000 a year for more incentive, but it does provide a real incentive. If you are on that very edge where your grant right now is $500 and your expenses are $700, I mean, if you get to keep half of the income you make during that month, it's a big help.
And that's how it was 10 years ago. There was that incentive in the program that was eliminated by the administration because they believed that was an excessive amount.
In effect, what you're doing by taking away that incentive is you're saying, well, here you've got somebody who's earning money and all of a sudden their income isn't $500 a month, but it's $800 a month. We don't want to be paying people $800 a month, so you cut back the welfare. And to do that, you make a dollar for donation.
Are you questioning a lot of your other points in
sure.
the vision there?
I'm sorry. The points were going to be, first of all, we ought to meet basic human needs, which we do to a mixed extent now. Number two would be enable the dependent to become independent, which is all these things, the job training, the education, child care and other social services, help in job placement, and as a last, subsidized work for disabled people who can't ever qualify for a subsidizing job, unsubsidized, and as a last resort, jobs to fill in the gaps. And then finally, again, as I said, that helps not only the not just the truly needy, but those who are trying to climb the ladder. And finally, the prevention of dependency for those who are not now, which means preventive health care, which you talked about. For somebody who's up there on the ladder now, but is falling below it, teenage pregnancy, those who are preventive health care would take care of it now. Those would be the three steps I would argue we have to do in order to stop this growing number of permanent dependency on welfare. And the best way is not to cut the benefits and then assume people are going to have incentive to work because they have nothing now, but to take care of those needs and then build from there.
You have to give people, when you get them in the job market, more incentive than a minimum wage. And I'm working with a company right now, and I'm fighting a management team that has come to the conclusion that you pay the minimum you can, and you do not give any positive steps for advancement or any reason to stay and work hard, and it's a disaster. I've been in supervisory for 20 years, and this is the first time in my life I've ever been. I've always worked in a union mill where you bid jobs, you moved up as you got more experience, wage increases came, whatever, things happen in a positive but a channel direction. Now a guy sits there and he says, I'm making darn near minimum wage. I got to work so many hours a week. There's no positives, it's all negatives. And I could see that whole cotton picking crew going on welfare in a week. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I could see 200 people saying, the hell with this.
Yeah, I think that is exactly that. Got to provide the incentives which are doing. I'm going to close it there. I'm going to close it there and talk more if you want to.